Okay, so where we were so far, we had this where type 2B and here we have a D3. And this is equivalent to like a D1 in the topological string on C3. And then we back reacted and we replace C3 by the manifold SL2C. So what I want to talk about today is, at least the first thing is, what lives on this D1 brain? Like what what are the fields that live here? There's going to be some subset of the fields on the D3. And maybe just to remind you something I said at the beginning, there's this story of, you know, Beam, Rastelli, and collaborators, where they take any n equals 2 superconformal field theory and turn it into a chiral algebra. So the thing living here is that chiral algebra. So of course, n equals 4, we have three complex scalars. I'll call them Z1, Z2, Z3. And these are associated to the normal directions of the brain. They tell me how my brain moves in the 10-dimensional geometry. So I'll write them like this. Z1 and Z2 tell me how I move in this copy of C3. And Z3 is how I move in this direction, which is kind of made equivariant. So in the twisted theory, Z3 goes away. You can think that is very massive. So this is because if we look, think, what are the equations of motions? Let's suppose I just have a single D3. It's like, the equations of motion describe the allowed configurations of my T3 brain here, which are still supersymmetric. Equations of motion are given by EPS configurations. And the omega background construction implies these live at the tip, that's at the origin. So it's just not allowed to move in that direction, so the field of Z3 isn't there. On the other hand, Z1 of little z, Z2 of little z must describe a holomorphic curve in C3. The BPS condition is that the world volume of my brain is some holomorphic curve. So that tells me these guys must be holomorphic. Okay. So this is just some heuristics as to get a feeling for the degrees of freedom that lives in this supersymmetric sector. So I'll write down the Lagrangian for these fields, which implies these equations. I'm not going to derive the Lagrangian from first principles, but you can. So the theory on the D1, which is the localized D3, has fields Z1, Z2, with Lagrangian. These are just matrix valued. So these are both of their spin a half, but bosonic. This is called symplectic fermions. Or sorry, symplectic bosons. and we also we perform BRST reduction using adjoint action, JLN action. So this part of the story, so these are the scalars and the BRST reduction. This is how you gauge chiral theories. And this this comes from the n equals 2 vector multiplet. Okay, so I'll maybe say in a sec what this BRST reduction is more concretely, but are there any questions?
Yeah. I have a piece. I forget why Z1 and Z2 have to be a homomorphic curve in C3.
I'm trying to think of the way to explain this. So, it's easiest to explain if we assume, you know, things get a little complicated if we want to draw, you know, a very wiggly holomorphic curve. But let's just draw a straight line. So the supersymmetries, there's a supercharge such that in Q cohomology, W d by dz bar vanishes. And if I want a brain which is preserved by that supercharge, it has to, you know, the function cutting it out has to be holomorphic. If you want to be a little more fancy, you can go look in the literature and say, you know, I have a manifold with SU3 holonomy. The group SU3 preserves a spinner. Every manifold with SU3 holonomy has a covariant constant spinner. We can say, what are the conditions for some locus to play well with that spinner? And you get some partial differential equations, which imply holomorphy. Okay, any other questions?
Sorry, I just get a little lost here. So you're performing this twist plus omega background,
mm-hmm.
and reduce this thing to R2 times C.
Well, the omega background, so when I do the twist, the fields on R2 look like the Durham complex of R2.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm replacing that by the equivariant Durham complex. That's what the omega background does. That equivariant localization turns out into a point.
And is there still this D3 brain, like?
Yeah. Yeah, the thing in the topological string, that its fields are like certain of the fields in the physical theory, physical D3 brain. And the allowed position of the D1 brain in the topological string is some of the possible positions of the D3 brain.
in particular, this d bar doesn't need to change. It's not.
D bar is only along one complex dimension, so it's not affected. So if I was to do this without the omega background, you would have something really similar, except everything would be tensored by that ROM complex of OR2. Okay. I assume, because you've been talking to Davide, that you all know how BRST reduction works, more or less. So let me say it very briefly.
Sir, and you also mentioned at the end that there is vector multiple. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Why should be? Is it because of supersymmetry, or it's because of some other degrees of freedom of the brain?
Like, where does the vector multiple come from?
Yeah.
So the n equals 4 Young-Mills consists of one n equals 2 vector multiplet,
yes,
and three n equals 2 hypermultiplets.
Okay. Yes. It's because okay, yes. So it's because of supersymmetry, basically.
Because of supersymmetry.
Okay.
Yeah. So firstly, so these fields have this OPE, of course, and then we introduce B of spin 2, C spin minus 1, the OPE, same kind of OPE, and these are also GLN valued. And the BRST charge, the BRST current, is a one-way product of trace, something like this. And the reduction so so you know that this expression is of spin 1. Why did I get this right? Writing something wrong. Sorry, I'm mixing up the spins for string theory and cage theory. Okay. So if this BRST charge acts on local operators, and we just take the cohomology. So if you haven't seen this before, you know, it looks a little weird, but actually,
Trace goes to the end.
Oh yeah, thanks. This is really, we're literally just gauging. You can rewrite this by saying there's a gauge field, which is a 0-1 form, and we're just coupling to that gauge field and dividing by gauge transformations. That will lead you to this expression. Okay. So the holographic dictionary is going to relate single trace elements of BRST cohomology n goes to infinity with states of Kadara-Spencer theory on SL2C. And of course, as you go further, we're going to find OPEs, the CFT, is going to be match some kind of scattering. Just as in usual holography. So what I was hoping to do today was to try to say a little bit about what are these states, and then try to say a little bit about what are these states, and then we'll see that they're the same thing. So this is, in ordinary ADS CFT, this is the very first thing you do. You look at this single trace operators n equals 4, and you see they look like the same thing as gravitational states in ADS 5 times S5. Okay, so let's, for this, I don't think I have time to really go through all the details of how to do the computation. So for finite n, the CRST cohomology is very hard. But for n infinite, it turns out to be easy due to some kind of old math results. Something called the Lode Quillen Segan theorem. So mathematicians happen to have studied similar problems in the 80s, and there is a nice theory that allows you to compute it very easily. So I'll write down the answer. It's going to be bosonic fields, bosonic operators, where this means symmetrized trace. So this is the most naive thing you could do, right? I want to write down gauge invariant operators. I have two matrix valued fields. I can just take the traces of the products of my matrix valued fields. And these turn out to be invariant under the BRST transformations. Oh, sorry, I missed a term. And then there's fermionic. In the last discussion, did Davide explain the n equals 2 superconformal algebra? I saw something like that on the board. Was that? No? I saw BRST and supercurrent G. This wasn't? No, okay. So I mentioned that, just like, how would you understand this? Let's assume that the trace, for simplicity, it's a standard thing to do in you know, ADS-CFT. You'll work with SUN instead of UN, so I'll just get rid of the trace. Which is just some kind of zero mode and is boring. So this one starts a trace Z1, Z2, and things like that. What are these guys? This is the SU2. These are the current for the SU2, which rotates Z1 and Z2. This one starts with trace E del C plus ZI del ZJ. And this, I hope you recognize, is the stress tensor. So each of these towers can be like, they're kind of infinite dimensional enhancements of the basic symmetries of my theory. I have a current rotating my two scalars, I have a stress tensor. And these guys, the lowest lying one here is trace B, Z1, Zi. These are some kind of supersymmetries. So the lowest lying part here is a superconformal algebra. Okay. So maybe this was just for people who are familiar with this kind of thing. I have a stress tensor, some current, and two fermionic generators. But if you look, the OPE between the fermionic generators can build the stress tensor. So that's a hallmark of having supersymmetry. And it can also build this. So this is exactly one of the superconformal algebras that some people might be familiar with. And I want to write down the various charges of all of these expressions. I'll raise this. Sorry, we just call these so if I take the A piece like that with Z1 to the or Z2 to the S, it's of spin. Well, the Zi are of spin 1/2, so it's spin or plus S over 2, and it's in an SU2 or symmetry representation of spin plus S over 2, again, or S over 2. Does that make sense?
I just hadn't noticed. So R and S are not indices. Like, there's a product of several.
Oh, sorry. I meant the power. It's the, yes, there's R Z1s and S Z2s.
Yeah.
Sorry about that. And the brackets indicates symmetrized traces. So because there's R S1s and S Z2s, They're in some representation, which is the orbis S, the symmetric power of the fundamental representation of SU2. So that's this representation. B, under the world sheet rotation, it's of spin orbis S2 plus 2. Yeah, SE2 or C. Here we find or plus S over 2 plus 1. And D is the same. So what have we done? We've enumerated the single trace states, and we've written down their quantum numbers. So we want to find like this spectrum in the dual theory. Now, if you want, you can go and study some paper from the 90s, which enumerates the spectrum of type 2b supergravity in ADS 5 times 5. And if you look for the BPS states, this is what you will find.
The spin, you read it from that Lagrangian? What is the spin here?
Well, Zi are spin half,
okay.
And B is spin 1, C is spin 0. So it's determined, essentially, by the fact that you want it to preserve Ohr symmetry, so Zs have to have the same spin, and you want the BRST charge to be of spin 1, so you can integrate it. Okay, so so doing the same analysis on supergravity is a little harder. So are there any questions before I try to explain how one does this?
Is this
n
equals
2?
Is it
n
equals
2? I think it's the n equals 2 superconformal algebra. It's the one that contains PSL 2/2 inside it. And while n equals 4 has PSL 4/4 inside it, so you would expect that to happen.
Sorry, can I just ask a question? I guess I understand what you're trying to compute. This kind of look like you're taking the fundamental representation tensoring many, many times, n times actually, and computing the endomorphism algebra and ask what happens when n goes to infinity. So it's kind of like a short while duality.
I think the fundamental. Well, it's easier than that. Actually, it's really. I mean, it's just classical. It's essentially classical invariant theory.
Right.
Because I'm looking at the invariant tensors. So, I mean, the Lodi Quillen Segan theorem is actually extremely easy. All it is you're looking at cyclic words whose entries are some matrices, and you want it to be invariant at a GLN, and you go read some paper of, I don't know, somebody from the 1890s who will tell you the invariant tensors. It's really quite tricky, you see, because so you get a co-chain complex, and at n equals infinity, you can kind of, we're using a spectral sequence. So a priori, the differential might take a single trace operator to a multi-trace operator. So we're dropping those terms, and then we see that the spectral sequence stops. But for finite n, you can't really do that, and it becomes a kind of horrifying mess. You can write it in terms of Lie algebra cohomology of a certain infinite dimensional Lie algebra. But this is a famously difficult thing to compute.
if I just take like a module of the VOA and ask what happens at infinity, for example, I could just take beta 1 says and set it to be 1 over z.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Is there still like an easy result as n equals infinity?
I think so, yeah. I think any kind of reasonable
module.
Kind of the thing you can do that's uniform in n, you think there's going to be an easy way to compute infinity.
I mean, I think of those as like kind of an interface in the like holomorphic topological theory. Is there like a...
Yes, you can. I mean, suppose I had some other D3 braid intersecting this at a point.
Oh, I see.
You'd get such a thing.
I see.
So this thing, this kind of thing appears in the work of Kasia and Davide. So like what they do is like at finite n, you can look, there's an element at finite n given by the determinant of the matrix Z. At infinite n, that's not really an element because it's going to be a huge infinite product. And it becomes a new module. It's the kind of thing they study. Okay. So I have to remind you the ordinary dictionary. If I'm on ADS, we say, I want to look at states. That correspond to local operators. At some point x in the boundary of ADS 3. These are the same as solutions to the equations of motion of the gravitational theory that satisfy a boundary condition everywhere except x. So I'm going to draw a picture. This is, say, ADS 2. Here's some point. I want to look at some solution to the equations of motion. And over here, it kind of tends asymptotically to the vacuum solution. Everywhere except this point, it's going to kind of tend towards the vacuum ADS 2 metric. But here, it has different boundary behavior. So this is the kind of thing you would find in Witten's 98 paper about ADS, about holography. So he would say, you know, you put something here and you look at the bulk boundary propagator, where the boundary point is that. That's going to be my bulk state. So I want to do this thing for the manifold SL2C. But in order to do that, we need to understand boundary conditions. So SL2C is, of course, the locus where U2 W1 is equal to 1. Let's compactify this. To the locus given by U1 W2 minus U2 W1 is equal to x squared. Here, ui x are homogeneous coordinates. And this is inside of CP 4. So this is just a really naive way to add on some locus at infinity. The boundary locus x equals 0 is CP1 times CP1. So for Sabrina's benefit, you can think of, you know, the boundary locus, x equals 0, it's like a 2 by 2 matrix of rank 0. Of course, that's up to scale. That was a CP1 times CP1. You can think of this as the space of null momenta. That's kind of off topic. So this one will have coordinates z. And this one will have coordinate w. So near the boundary, SLT z bar, it looks like there's some, this is only a first approximation, the bundle O1, comma 1. And I'm going to have a coordinate n on the fiber. So n has a pole at z equals infinity, w equals infinity. And the volume form looks like dn dz dw over n cubed. Yeah, that's right. Has a third order pole of the boundary. And you see this is regular at z equals infinity and w equals infinity because the poles generated by dz are canceled by the thing there. So the reason I'm doing this is writing this compactification is analogous to thinking about a very small neighborhood of the boundary in ADS3. So the CP1 with the z coordinate we think of as the boundary of ADS3. And the CP1 with the w coordinate is S3 modulo U1. So these are related by a hop vibration. And so our goal is to study states in that sense, which live at a point in this curve. So this is quite involved. So are there any questions about how we're doing this?
Yeah. Oh, was this like compactification selection was made arbitrarily, or there is a reason to take this compactification?
What you want is any compactification such that there are no zero modes. So that when I extend my fields across the divisor in some way, you choose a way to do that, that there's no double cohomology.
You mean like for Kadaira-Spencer's theory, you don't want to have zero modes.
Yes, exactly.
And it means that, like, in a sense, your manifold is rigid. There are no global deformations.
Absolutely, absolutely, yeah.
Why? I mean, Is there a physical reason to expose this?
Well, I want to do things like if you want to compute correlation functions,
uh-huh.
you don't want to have to integrate over zero mode moduli because that
yeah.
integral might not converge.
I understand, but like sometimes what we want is not what we have.
Well, you can build something with no zero modes, and it's and that's a nice thing, so you might as well do that.
Okay.
And another reason is, you know, when there's no zero modes, the propagator is well defined and more, it's kind of unambiguous. So again, so you can compute two-point functions.
But okay, but once we impose these conditions and we want compactification to have vanish into a block of homology, we're like it's unique. Yes.
It's not. I don't think it's unique. I think you could always do some kind of blow up on the boundary or something like that.
Uh-huh.
But that's not going to change the correlation functions.
Oh.
Because the propagator is unique. So like if I do some blow up, I'll get maybe the propagator upstairs, once I push it forward, has to become the propagator downstairs.
Mm-hmm. And do I understand correctly that the divider, like the divider which we have, it's not, but the focus, boundary locus, it's exactly the one which we had before the correction where we had delta function. It's the same place.
Oh, the geometry is a little tricky. It's not quite that. So if you remember the Beltrami differential, so the Beltrami differential was like the Bochner-Martinelli kernel here times del z. So this means it's a bundle over the space fibers z, c. And this bundle, the Bochner-Martinelli kernel blows up near the origin, but it vanishes off at infinity. So once I go off to infinity in C2, you kind of recover this copy. You recover the coordinate z.
Mm-hmm.
So this CP1, this CP1 happens. So at infinity, when I compactify this, you get a CP1 W at infinity. And what was before like a non-trivial fibration becomes a trivial fibration over here.
Mm-hmm.
So this CP1 is happening at infinity.
Okay.
Okay, and an important technical point is the geometry isn't exactly this, it's a deformation of this. This is a first approximation, which is sufficient for our current purposes. So how do we write down states? I want to write down a boundary condition. So I'm only going to do this for the easiest piece of Kodaira-Spencer theory. Include something I called alpha I. The integral where the Lagrangian was this kind of higher dimensional BC system. So omega has a pole of order 3. On the boundary. Because it, you know, it has a 1 over n cubed in it. So to make a well-defined extension of the theory to the boundary, I want to say that alpha 1 has a 0 of order 1. And alpha 2 has a 0 of order 2. So then the zeros here cancel the pole. And you can check that this implies no zero modes. Now the Dalbo cohomology of my compactified geometry with coefficients in these line models happen to vanish.
But sorry, Kevin. I don't know exactly what we're doing now.
Sorry about that.
I mean, because, okay, here we compactified something here. We found there's a volume form on... by the way, I'm realizing... we found some volume form. Was it on the CP1, by the way?
So the volume form, this is the SL2C volume form.
SL2C, right? Yeah.
But I'm writing it in these coordinates near the boundary.
Okay.
So what I'm doing is analogous to saying, you know, the ADS2 metric looks like 1 over y squared.
Okay.
So this is the form of the volume form near the boundary.
Okay. And but the question is, okay, what are we doing here? So there is a Cadet-Spencer fields.
These are two of the fields. I know I want to give a boundary condition to my fields.
Okay.
So I want to say, like, when I go to the boundary, the fields must have some kind of polar zero as I expand near the boundary.
Okay.
This is what I'm saying. I want these fields to have a first order zero and a second order zero.
Okay, and I'm also partly confused because at some point, I remember we had that was a complex structure.
Yeah, so I'm going to focus, that's the hard part of Cadet-Spencer theory.
Okay.
So I'm going to focus on the easy part. So Cadet-Spencer theory consists of this hard part, which is like the analog of the graviton, but two really simple things, like basically fermions.
Okay.
So the analogous thing, if I was studying physical ADS5, I would say, I'm going to focus on some free fermions and see how they look near the boundary.
Okay.
And match that with some sector of the Joule theory.
Okay. Okay. So this is some other field content. Okay. It's some fermions that have this action, and you're now imposing boundary conditions at n equals 0, which is where the boundary is.
Yeah.
Fair enough.
And I want my boundary conditions, I'm just building them so that the action makes sense.
Fair enough.
Can you explain again what is the U1 in the CP1 with coordinate W? Like, does that exist in the ADS5 case?
I see where I'm saying that the CP1 is the base of the hop vibration of this S3. I don't know, but I think it's not so important in any case, because if we're working on ADS3 times S3, we can kind of compactify to ADS3, so we're retaining the KK modes. And if we want, we can first compactify along this vibration and then compactify to ADS3. So because I'm not asking for any kind of locality here, it's not so important.
Okay. So that U1 doesn't mean anything physically?
No. Okay. It's just, you know, I'm choosing. Yeah. Well, when I go to the boundary, the way I'm describing the boundary, it's convenient to write it in such a way that the S3 collapses, but it's not very important.
Oh.
Okay. So the punchline is supposed to be, we're going to write down states which satisfy a modified boundary condition. And these are going to be of the exact same quantum numbers as we found in the gauge theory. So let's see if we can do that. So we want to find alpha 1, alpha 2, which satisfy the boundary condition, except at n equals 0 and z equals 0. So there's a very simple solution. So let me write down the kind of very naive way to generate the answer. And maybe if there's time, I can try to convince you why this is everything. Is I say, alpha 1. I need to get my notes, maybe. A delta function at z equals 0 times 1 over n some power times w to l or l. So this becomes as n has a pole, okay. So I think you will agree this very simple expression satisfies this equation. And alpha 1 is equal to 0 at n equals 0, z not equal to 0. So let's check that this guy has the right quantum numbers. So before, did I erase the quantum numbers? I think I did. Sorry about that. That was important. The fermionic states trace B, things like this, which is of spin 1 plus or plus S over 2, SU2 representation spin or plus S over 2. So the key point is the difference between the spin under the conformal transformations and the spin under the SU2 flavor symmetry is 1. So I want to show that those guys are the same as these guys. So let's look at this thing. Delta z equals 0 is of spin 1. 1 over n to the k is of spin k over 2. And because w to the l for naught less than or equal to l less than or equal to k is an SU2 or rep, as SU2 or rotates the CP1 of spin k over 2. So again, it's a spin 1 plus k over 2, SU2, spin k over 2.
One thing, naively, it seems to have a pole as n goes to 0. So I'm missing something.
That's important, right? Like, I'm saying the boundary condition is going to be, like, as the normal boundary conditions, as I go to the boundary, it vanishes. But I'm saying I want to look at a state which satisfies that condition except at z equals 0. So if z was not 0, it's fine. If z is 0, that's OK, because I'm allowed to look at such things.
Okay.
So I think I missed why, like, you consider if this exception. Could you remind me?
Why do we consider?
Why satisfying boundary condition except it and then z equals?
Yeah, so I mean, this is something that comes from the way physicists like to do holography. So the way I would like to say it, which I don't think some physicists might not like, is that if I insert an operator at the boundary, I'm going to change the field equations at that point. So since the boundary condition is part of the field equations.
I see. So like you were really describing like a physical setup with a prescribed boundary defect.
Exactly.
And you're asking what are all the possible solutions
yes.
to this boundary defect, and these are all.
Yeah. Well, up to gauge equivalence. And I mean, you can say, if I want to say alpha 1 has a pole like this, let me get a new blackboard. So we can think of it saying, so we're modifying the field equations so that d bar alpha 1 in this case is like w to the l delta function n equals 0 kth derivative. So we can obtain this by adding the boundary operator which is going to be, say, integral over the w-plane of some derivatives, I think. Because then I also have integral alpha 1 d bar alpha 2 plus. Now I vary alpha 2, you'll pick up something like this. So these things I'm inserting at the boundary are also literally boundary operators where I average some of my fields over a CP1 of the boundary. In the original ADS3 times S3, you would obtain them by averaging your fields over S3.
Thanks. Mm-hmm. And the W's there just to generate a family, like a basis of some sort.
Yeah. You want to write down all of the operators. The most general operator. Again, if this was an S3, I could average it against some harmonic function or something.
Yeah. Right.
So is this what alpha 1 looks like in the bulk or just close to the boundary?
This is just very close to the boundary. So I'm making an approximation. I'm only describing the boundary geometry slightly approximately, and if there's actually some corrections here, which are important because if you want to compute the two-point function, the holographic two-point function is not zero because of those corrections. Okay, so I should stop it so you continue. So similarly, boundary operators built from U are equivalently fields with modified boundary conditions. Give the bosonic and B towers. It's just the computation is a little more tricky because the field is a 2-1 form and you just have to fiddle around with those tensors. Okay. Maybe I'll stop there. Are there questions?
Is that
at some point in the collider, this is an approximate geometry?
Mm-hmm. So this is a It's this plus corrections, which are small in n. So the full geometry has a Beltrami differential, which is some expression involving n, which I forget. Ah, here it is. The full geometry has this Beltrami differential, n squared. So this describes the patch of SLTC where n not equal to 0 and z not equal to infinity. Well, SLTC bar, say. So this describes a nice open patch of SLTC bar. So I have to add on this Beltrami differential. And that means when I solve this equation, you have to add on other terms. But you can just calculate what they are by solving the equation explicitly.
So what are you approximating it to? Like,
is
just flat?
I'm approximating. So this is a bundle over CP1 times CP1. So I'm approximating the geometry near the boundary as this bundle.
So it's approximation and x goes to 0.
Yeah, as n goes to 0, as the normal direction goes
to 0.
Yes, because of the Beltrami differential, which the deviation is of order n squared.
Yeah, but like x and n is the same coordinate. Or
What was x? Oh, yes, x goes to 0. X and n is the same coordinate. Yes,
zero.
Yes, x goes to 0.
So n is kind of like x over some w times u.
Something like that, yeah.
W2 times u2.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So n is holomorphic in this approximation, but not in the
mass. Yeah. So this delta z equals 0 term will cause a problem because that's not no longer holomorphic. So you pick up terms which involve the derivative of the delta function times lower powers in n. And then you have to cancel those with something else. But this is kind of fun because if you actually were to compute the whole thing, so if I draw a picture, this is kind of the boundary. And my approximation, my state looked like this. It's a straight line going away from the boundary. But that's not really right. It kind of radiates outwards when you look at it more carefully. And then that means you can compute a two-point function by evaluating it at some other point.
Is there some principle which allows you to describe the space of operators on the boundary, allowed operators? So in case of chiral algebra, I understand like what operators are good and what are not good. And like what kind of operators I can write down, which are reasonable or which span the whole algebra.
Right, so you choose a boundary condition so that the Lagrangian makes sense in the compactified geometry. And then you just you do the usual procedure. You look at, okay, I just have some kind of theory whose coupling tends to zero on the boundary. And I just write down the operators I can build from the fundamental field. And I take PRST cohomology or something.
PRST cohomology of chiral algebra?
For the Kadara-Spencer act.
Ah, for Kadara-Spencer.
Yeah.
So you have like two kinds of PRST cohomologies.
Yes, because Kadara-Spencer is also a kind of a gauge theory. But actually, I mean, to write down the spectrum, we might as well take the free Kadara-Spencer theory.
Mm-hmm.
And then to write down the operators, that amounts to studying some Dolbeau cohomology problem. So it's not difficult.
So in terms of Dolbeau cohomologies, this is some kind of relative Dolbeau cohomologies, yes?
Yeah.
So like basically, trig operators are parameterized by these cohomologies.
Yeah. I mean, one way to say it is, you know, if I look at d bar of this, it's a delta function supported on a CP1 in the boundary. So you can look at the Dalbach cohomology with support.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the answer.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like homology of O of SLTC bar, coefficient some line bundle, and with support on z equals 0. So the reason this is the correct thing is because there are no zero modes. So there's some exact sequence which says any such thing extends uniquely to a field in the whole thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's another thing which I wanted to add. So like usually in the setup when people are talking about like logical strings and mirror symmetry probably, they like to have for B models some manifolds with complex modulus, right?
Yes, absolutely.
And that's opposite to what you have here.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, and like what happens if you, so it's like for this setup it's bad to have complex modulus, yes?
Yes, it certainly makes your life harder.
Okay, interesting.
I mean, that's a really interesting question because you could look at SL2C modulo copy of Z, and I think that would have moduli because it's related to an elliptic curve.
What do you mean moduli Z?
You take a copy of Z inside, say the SL2C is an action of left and right actions.
Okay.
So you take a copy of Z inside one of those copies of SL2C.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the interest is like this. That's an integer.
Mm-hmm.
And then you quotient by it.
Ah, I see.
And that's going to be related to studying the dual theory on an elliptic curve.
Oh, okay.
So then you might expect moduli, I think.
Interesting. Yeah, and like, sorry, last question. Like, in usual, like, the basic check of like holographic prescription is matching of asymptotic symmetries in the bulk and like symmetry on the boundary.
Yes.
What is this matching in this case?
Okay, the weakest statement of that is, both of them have an action of SL2 times SL2.
Mm-hmm.
But that's really dumb. There's a much more interesting statement, which we were able to check, and it's quite a bit harder. So the manifold SL2 is an infinite dimensional symmetry algebra of divergence-free holomorphic vector fields. And you can find that also as symmetries of the chiral algebra in the planar limit. So is it that was like the best kind of check we were able to do.
Is it what is called W1 plus, like W small 1 plus, 1 plus infinity?
It's not quite that because that's volume preserving symmetries of a plane and this is the volume preserving symmetries of a threefold of a conic.
Ah, okay, also fold, fold.
But I mean, of course, there's some relations between them.
Yeah, and my question was with regards to what Kasia was, because I didn't fully understand where is it that we made an approximation that did require these corrections here. Or how the Tormi differential, by the way, because I also have very little intuitions about it. Where did it enter? Does it enter in the definition of D bar in some sense, the Tormi differential?
Yes, it enters in the definition of D bar.
Okay.
So this state here I've written, as written, does not satisfy d bar but a zero.
So I should add this piece to the d bar, and right now we didn't add it.
Right now we didn't add because if I just want to enumerate how many states there are, that's actually not so important.
Okay, just sheer enumeration, just sheer counting.
Yeah. If I want to write down the explicit solution and compute scattering, it's very important.
Okay.
So that straight line that you wrote, it's supposed to be some boundary to bulk propagator?
Okay. So
it doesn't even satisfy the equations of motion yet.
Yeah, so like the straight line was like the naive boundary bulk propagator where I just put in a delta function, and that's only valid in some approximation when I'm very close to the boundary. But the true one has these corrections which make it kind of radiate in this direction.
And using those corrections, that would still be like some like the semi-classical version. Like you can after that do some loops and like with diagrams and all that.
Yeah. So basically, I mean, if I wanted to compute the holographic three-point function, I would write down my state, including all these corrections for three different fields, and I take the product of them and integrate it. And that would be the usual written diagram picture where I have multi-boundary propagators. It's tricky to do that, though.
And ask just another question. Like I think so far what I gathered was that you showed us that there are these operators on the boundary. There are these states you can build that's like kind of like look like giving a singularity to these fields that I should also interpret as local operators on the boundary.
Mm-hmm.
And then you showed us that these two have matching quantum numbers.
Yes, with the CFT and the gravitational theory. Yes.
But it's not, how do I see them as the kind of naturally these two are the same boundary, actual boundary loop operators? For example, like, can I think of this as like, oh, I have a B goes there, therefore I give B an order 0 and C an actual pole?
No, you're not going to, if by B goes you mean a B ghost of the like the 2D system, you're never going to see an individual field of the 2D systems. You only ever see gauge invariant things. It's like nothing tells you about the group GLA.
I guess I'm just asking, like, how do I see this as the actual, like, now I have these local operators. I understand them as like local operators.
Yeah, on the boundary, yes.
The boundary.
Right, so we have a vertex algebra on the boundary. And then the conjecture is there is an isomorphism of vertex algebras between this and the one from the 2D CFT.
One from 2D CFT. I see. And you're literally just matching. There's no intuition of why these two must match.
I mean, there sort of is, but it's a little tricky. I mean, I always get kind of confused around this point. But my intuition would be, suppose we made the back reaction very small. So then I add, and this compactifies into some kind of CP2. Something like this. And then I put an operator So if I placed an operator there, it's going to source a field which goes off into the middle of the C2. And if I insert my brain at the origin of C2, the gravitational theory will couple and induce an operator on the brain. So that's why operators at infinity of the gravitational theory look like local operators in the brain. It's a rough idea. Like, does that make sense? I mean, because like on the brain, I can couple to the fields of greater expansive theory. And if I wanted to see a local operator in the brain, I should couple to a Guattari-Spencer theory field, which is like delta function z equals 0 and stuff. Well, this thing will have a pole at infinity. So it will be sourced by something at infinity.
Your claim is that source this one.
Yeah. Yeah. My claim is that everything is made complicated by the back reaction and this kind of, which appears here. But if we drop that and I just look at this delta function, and I follow it back into the middle and see how does it change my brain? It inserts a local operator.
Yeah, I guess my question is like, how easy is it to see that induces
the right local operator? I don't think that's hard. If we throw away the back reaction, then it's easy because we just look for how does the theory on the brain couple to Kadara Spencer theory, and there's a formula for this. And from that formula, I think you can get to here. I mean, maybe not easy, but I think it's manageable.
Thanks. Also, very naively, I realize now that how were we counting the spin on these guys? I can see it on the chiral algebra how we count the spin. But what does it mean in delta has been 1?
Oh, because it's delta means d bar of 1 over z.
Sorry, I didn't hear. D bar of 1 over z.
Yes, d bar of 1 over z, and z has spin minus 1, so 1 over z has spin 1.
Okay, and what about 1 over n to the k?
That's because with the line bundle it's in. It's in the bundle O1, 1, which means n really transforms as a tensor.
Okay.
It transforms as like dz to the minus 1/2.
Okay. So the conformal transformations or z will change the n,
mm-hmm.
like with it. Okay. So it has spin 1/2 or.
It's like, well, 1 over n has been spin 1/2.
Okay. And then, oh yeah, then I also do not, so we use the, what is it, what's the name of the tautological line bundle, or the
mm-hmm.
one?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, yeah. Is there any quick way to get into the intuition? Yeah, it just says the information properties of the orthogonal coordinate, or?
So, it just means, I mean, it's the things that transform as 1 over square root of dz dw.
Okay.
Like, minus 1 transforms as square root dz dw.